the hell that I was in, I'd do anything to be better.
I thought like a lunatic.
You kind of just have like that little bit of hope that it will get better.
You're gonna make it.
This began my surrender.
I am a witness of my own growth.
It's a life beyond your wildest dreams, and I just have to say, it works if you work it.
My story, that's what I share.
You're listening to Far From Finished, a weekly podcast where we share new, real-life stories of hope and triumph, told by the people who live them. Today's story comes to us from...
My name is Terrence, and my sobriety date is August 28th, 2012. I was born in New York. I was born in Staten Island, New York. I grew up in a good family. You know, my father worked on Wall Street. He was a bond broker. My mother was a stay-at-home mom. I have two older brothers and an older sister. And, you know, I grew up in, it's one of the five boroughs of New York, but it was more of a suburban part. You know, it was a very tight-knit community. I grew up in a place called West Brighton. And, growing up, it was a good childhood. You know, I considered it a good childhood. You know, I played a lot of sports. I played basketball. I played baseball. You know, I wasn't great in school, but, you know, I wasn't, you know, failing every class, but, you know, I excelled more in sports. And, as time went on, you know, the first time I had a drink was right around, you know, 11, 12 years old. So going back, you know, before that, you know, I did excel in sports. I always wanted to be the, you know, the best at everything I did. And, you know, that always was a pretty heavy weight I carried around as a kid. And, the first time I had a drink was, I was at a wedding, and, I went up to the bartender and, you know, I ordered a glass of wine for a family member, and, you know, they gave me the glass of wine. They didn't ask me any questions. And, I brought it back to the family member, and, you know, the rest of the night I continued to order glasses of wine. And, but I used them, I drank them myself. And, you know, by the end of the night, I was blackout drunk. You know, I'd gotten in trouble. My father and my mother knew I was drunk, but, obviously, you know, the next morning I'm hungover, but I'm sitting there and I'm apologizing. I'm telling my mom, you know, how sorry I am for, you know, what I did last night. But, you know, that weight that I had, that I felt, you know, the weight that, you know, I was carrying around trying to be perfect and trying to do everything right, you know, the glass of wine had relieved that weight, you know, the weight was lifted. And, you know, I felt like I could be myself. I felt like, you know, I felt comfortable in my own skin. And even though I was sitting there apologizing, saying I'll never do this again, you know, I thought I found the solution. And, you know, from that point on, I was seeking alcohol and drugs. So as time goes on, you know, around 12 years old, 12, 13, I started smoking pot. You know, whenever I did something, I did it, you know, at 110%. Yeah, I didn't, you know, when I started smoking pot, I didn't just smoke pot like every Friday night. When I started smoking pot, I smoked every single day. And, you know, that's just the way I did things. And, you know, as, you know, I got into high school and sports, you know, started, you know, get more serious. You know, now I'm playing, you know, varsity baseball. You know, I'm also on the basketball team. And, you know, I had a lot of friends. You know, I considered myself to be a pretty popular kid, you know. And that weight, you know, that weight continued to get heavier. I always needed to be perfect. And that's the way that I saw it. I always needed to be perfect. And, you know, if you looked at me from the outside, you know, it probably looked like I was doing pretty well. But, you know, I was struggling with a lot of things, and I never was able to ask for help. I was never able to, you know, articulate what was really going on. And, my solution was drugs and alcohol. And, things at home started to get pretty rough. Our family had, my brothers and sister, they moved out of the house. They're older than me. So I was the only one left at home, and, things weren't going too well. My parents weren't getting along very well. And, it's the way that I dealt with it again, was the easy, I took the easy way out. And I didn't deal with that stuff. I just, I hid, and I went out with my friends, and I just tried to ignore it. And, eventually, we had lost our house. Our house had got foreclosed on. Some things happened, or financially, where it just, it was tough to deal with as a, 16, 17 year old kid. And now, I put no blame on anybody else. My mother did the best she could. My father did the best he could. And, I think they did a really good job raising three kids and, four kids, three boys and a daughter. Everyone is doing really well. So, people go through tough times, and I just, as a teenager, I just didn't know how to deal with them. But on the other side of it, baseball was something that I loved to do, and I was very successful in it. And, I had a bunch of scouts at my games. I was really doing well at baseball, and, I would go out and I'd pitch seven innings, I'd throw a no hitter, and then I'd, go out and start doing coke, and I remember there was, one night I was at this party, and I just pitched such a, a really good game, and I'm sitting there and I'm doing lines of cocaine, and the girl next to me says to me, she goes, you did so well today. Why are you doing this? And I didn't think anything of it. And, in high school, I really started to get deeper into my addiction, cocaine, Xanax, really anything you put in front of me, anything that would make me feel better, anything that would take me out of myself. And, my senior year in high school, I did really well in baseball. And, that year, that summer, I got drafted in the 20th round by the Montreal Expos. And that's what I worked for, my whole entire life. I knew I wanted to play baseball. So, I finally felt like I accomplished something. And, within a couple of months after that, I had, I had gotten arrested for assault while I was high. I also got arrested for theft while I was high. I totaled my father's car, while I was drunk and high. And, you would think someone who had just accomplished their, their life goal wouldn't be doing so much to self-sabotage. But, I was going through a tough time. And, the crazy thing is there were no consequences to my actions. So, I got arrested twice and I totaled the car, and I probably spent a total of, 3 to 5 hours in jail. Nothing happened. I lived in a smaller, area, tight neighborhood. So people knew what my future was going to be. They knew that, I was going to go on to play professional baseball, and nobody wanted to get in the way of that. Nobody wanted me to get in trouble. So all the things that I did were kind of, brushed under the table. They just let it go. And, I felt like I couldn't get in trouble. I felt like I was there was no consequences to anything. So I could, things went on smoothly after that stuff happened. And I didn't sign with the baseball team. I ended up going to junior college for a year in Florida. And the reason why I did that was, I felt like I could have got more money out of the draft, and I felt like I could have got drafted higher. So I decided to go to college for a year to try to improve my draft status. And, you know, I got to college, you know, now I'm, you know, by myself. My father's not there. My mother's not there. You know, my father and mother, you know, they saw what was going on. They, you know, when I was at home, they kind of, you know, my father would kind of be able to reel it back in for me, you know, tell me that I'm messing up, you know, punish me. Yeah, obviously not let me out. But now, you know, now I'm on my own. And, you know, the Xanax use got really bad. I started using cocaine, you know, on a pretty daily basis, and or whenever I can get my hands on it. And within a couple of months in the fall, I had, you know, I got dropped from some classes, and, you know, I was ineligible to play. I ended up going back to school during Christmas time, so I was eligible for the spring. And I was able to do that, and then I went back to school in the spring, and the same thing happened. You know, I never was able to learn from my mistakes. I just continued to do the same thing over and over again. And, you know, I got dropped from a couple of classes. I was ineligible to play in the spring. And, you know, at this point, they just suspended me and said, you know, basically, they just kind of said, we're done with you. And, yeah, I was able to go. I went back to New York. I was able to kind of clean it up for a little bit. And I ended up signing with the team, with the Expos. And I went back to Florida. You know, I played my first year of professional baseball. You know, I didn't have any, you know, I didn't get in trouble or anything like that. And you know, then the Expos turned into the Washington Nationals, and yeah, I go back, and the next couple of years, I'm drinking a lot. I'm not doing the right thing. And, you know, I've gotten in trouble a couple of times. At one point I got suspended and sent home for 2 weeks. And, you know, while I was home for that 2 weeks, I was, you know, I had to see a psychiatrist. So I started seeing a psychiatrist, and, you know, that's the first time anyone ever asked me if I thought I was an alcoholic. And, you know, as a teenager or a young adult, you think an alcoholic or a drug addict is, you know, the guy begging for money on the side of the street. And, you know, that's not true. It's false. But that's the way that I looked at it. And, you know, when the guy asked me if I was an alcoholic, yeah, I basically laughed at him. I said, what do you mean? Yeah, I play professional baseball. You know, I don't know many alcoholics that play professional baseball. And, you know, my ego was so big, and my ego got in the way. And, you know, everybody else around me could see it. You know, the only person that couldn't see it was me. And, yeah, I was so full of fear that I would never want to admit, you know, that I was anything like that. And so the team took me back, you know, and one all season when I was back at home in New York, and I got into a car accident. I was drunk. And I was high, and I fell asleep at the wheel at like 3 o'clock in the morning, and I totaled my father's car again. And I didn't get in trouble. I didn't get arrested or anything like that. But I did go to the hospital after, and, you know, I had hurt my back, and I was having some back issues already, but this one, you know, it didn't feel good after the accident. So I went to the emergency department, and they, they wrote me a prescription for Vicodin, a small prescription. I left and I took them, and I didn't have any left, and I wanted more. So I went to the doctor, and the doctor wrote me a script for 150 Vicodin and 150 Xanax. You know, and that's when my physical addiction started. And I started taking them every day. you know, they were easy to get because I was, you know, I was a clean cut kid, you know, who played professional baseball. So I went to a doctor, you know, they asked if I asked for it, they gave it to me. You know, I don't think they suspected that I was really having any type of addiction issues. And, you know, now I'm on the disabled list. I'm hurt. I go to spring training. I'm in spring training and I go out one night, you know, I get into it at the bar, you know, I embarrass myself, you know, which is becoming a normal occurrence. You know, when I go out at night, I can't control my drinking. So I end up looking like, you know, I'm not doing the right things. And so I come back to the room and I call my trainer in the morning and I just, you know, I tell him I don't want to do this anymore. And I think I'm going to go home. So I basically quit. You know, I told him that I just, you know, I didn't want to play anymore. And I didn't want to sit on the sidelines and just watch. So I went home and, you know, I went back to Staten Island. And now, you know, my mother and father are living apart. So I, you know, I have to live with one of them. And, you know, I'm living, I get a job, work in landscaping. And, you know, after a few months, you know, I'm fully addicted to prescription painkillers. You know, I'm taking them every single day. You know, I'm not really making any money that I make. I'm spending on drugs or alcohol. And, you know, I realized that I can't do this. This is not the way I'm supposed to be living. And I realized that I just gave up the biggest opportunity, you know, what I worked for my whole life. So I called my trainer and I called the player coordinator and I asked for, you know, I asked to come back. And, you know, to my surprise, they let me come back. And it was on, you know, there was one stipulation. I had to call my pitching coach every single night at 10 o'clock. And I had to tell the pitching coach that, you know, I was home and I wasn't, you know, I wasn't getting in any trouble. I was, you know, that everything was okay. And, you know, I did that for spring training. I had a really good spring training. I got assigned to a full season team in Hagerstown, Maryland. And the pitching coach that I'm calling every night at 10 o'clock, he's, you know, my coach there. And the first month, you know, it's, you know, I have the best month of my life, you know, and I'm doing really well. And I'm not drinking, I'm not doing anything wrong. And then, you know, I got called into the manager's office and they told me that I was getting moved up to the team above me. And, you know, that team was the roster was very, very good. You know, there's a bunch of future, you know, there was a bunch of future major leaguers on that team. And, you know, that weight, you know, of that pressure I felt to like be the best, you know, it was in full effect. And especially because I wasn't doing anything to help my disease. I wasn't doing anything to help with my addiction. I was just not drinking or using drugs. So, you know, when I got there, I was, you know, pretty stressed out. I was pretty tense. And, you know, the first game I pitched, you know, I think I gave up 7 runs and a third of it, like an inning and a third. You know, I gave up a home run to Matt Wieters. And, you know, I came out of that game and I just, you know, I didn't feel good about myself. And, you know, I pitched a couple of more games and I wasn't doing well. And my solution to that was, you know, it was, I went to my trainer and I told him, you know, I'm having some issues with my wisdom teeth. I need to go to the dentist. And, you know, I went to the dentist and, you know, they pulled the wisdom tooth and, you know, they gave me some Percocets and then it was it. I was back at it. And within about a month, I got moved back down to the team that I was on in the beginning of the year. And that pitching coach was there and, yeah, you know, I'm not calling them at 10 o'clock anymore because, you know, they kind of realize what's going on. And, you know, I had it's one of the last games of the season, last week or two, and I'm pitching in, you know, the eighth, ninth inning, and I'm not pitching well. I'm still hungover from the night before, and you know, I get called into the manager's office, and you know, it's the player coordinator, my manager, hitting coach, pitching coach, and you know, my pitching coach is sitting there, and he's, you know, I could see it. You know, he's just so disappointed, and he's just, you know, looking at me, and he just looked at me, and he said to me, he goes, "Why are you doing this? And, you know, why do you continue to do this to yourself?" And that's the first time that I ever realized that I had no control over what my, I had no control when I had, when I used drugs or alcohol. So I had no, I couldn't answer that question, you know, because I really wanted to succeed in baseball. Baseball was my goal. That was my dream. You know, I worked hard, you know, and, you know, even though I like self-sabotaged and I went out and I did all this stuff, like I really wanted to do well. So when he asked me that question, I had no answer for it. You know, I realized that I have a problem. That's the first time I realized that I really have an issue. And, you know, I went home that day and, you know, I drank. Just what I did, you know, I just drank. And, you know, within a cut, you know, I actually, you know, the next year I had a good year. I eventually got taken in the Rule 5 draft by the Mariners. So now I'm in spring training with the Mariners in Arizona. And, you know, as a kid, going back to when I was a kid, my favorite baseball player was Ken Griffey Jr. You know, I did everything like Ken Griffey Jr. I tried to hit like him. That's who I love to watch. And, you know, I wanted to be like, and, you know, I'm sitting in Arizona in the Mariners locker room, and Ken Griffey Jr. is, you know, in the same locker room as me. And, you know, it was a really good feeling. And at this point I had cleaned up and I was in shape and I was ready for spring training, but I was still having pretty bad back issues. And I was really hoping that because I was in such good shape, my back issues would get better. They didn't. And, you know, the Mariners front office called me in and they told me that, you know, at this point, back surgery is going to cost too much money and we're just going to let you go. So I'm out of a job. So I'm on my way home back to New York, and, you know, just to give you an example of how I dealt with my problems, you know, the first thing I did when I got to the airport was I started drinking. I probably spent about $400 at that airport bar. And when I landed in New York, the first thing I did was I went straight to my drug dealer and, you know, got some painkillers. And, you know, within about a year and a half, I was having some pretty major, you know, issues. And, you know, I was physically, mentally, you know, addicted, you know, to drugs and alcohol I was addicted in every single way. And, you know, there was a couple of periods of, you know, there was a couple of weeks there where I tried to sober up. I was living in, Brooklyn, and, you know, I was dating this girl and I was trying to sober up for her. And, you know, I think I was clean for a couple of weeks there without anything. And, you know, I got this phone call one day from a friend and, you know, asking me if I want to like hang, if I want to do something. So, you know, that day, you know, I took a Klonopin, and, you know, within an hour I was back at the doctor. I had my prescriptions. You know, as soon as the girl walked in the door and saw my face, she knew that I was high. And she did the right thing by telling me to leave. You know, it wasn't, you know, she knew right away, and it, she told me that if I came home high again, that was it. And again, that was the right thing to do. And I left. I got high, and the next thing I know, I woke up in an ambulance, and they had hit me with Narcan. And I woke up at the EMT, and I'm thanking him because he said that I'd stopped breathing. I fell asleep on the Staten Island Ferry, waiting for the Staten Island Ferry. And, I stopped breathing and I OD'd. And, luckily somebody found me. I don't know who did, because I just woke up in the ambulance. But, they brought me back to life. And just to show you how strong my addiction and my disease is, I got to the hospital in, downtown Manhattan. And, I'm sitting there asking for medication because now I'm sick because, the Narcan put me, now I'm not feeling well. And I'm asking for prescription pills. So they won't give me any. And I ripped all the IVs out. I went across the street. I still had my, pills from the doctor. And I got high again in a Starbucks bathroom. And I just, I look back on it now and it's like, whoa, like, how could you do that? But in the moment, I didn't think anything of it. I just didn't want to feel the way I felt. And, I continue to let people down. And, I was living with this guilt and shame, but I wasn't trying to fix it. I was just making it worse. And, within a couple of months, my sister, who, my sister's my best friend, she knew I had problems. She tried to help me so many times. And, she eventually told me, she was like, you can't come to my house anymore. I don't want the kids to see you like this. And, for her to say that, it really like hit me hard because I just, I love being around my nieces and nephews. I love being there. My mother told me I had to leave. Which again, was the right thing to do. It's not fair to her to watch me, watch me live in her apartment and basically kill myself in front of her. That's not something somebody should have to see. And my father, again, just didn't want, he knew what I was doing. He didn't want to deal with it. Same thing. It's just, my family was doing the right thing by telling me I can't do this anymore. I can't live there anymore. And, so a year and a half before, I'm in the locker room with Ken Griffey Jr. And now I'm homeless and I have nowhere to live and I have nowhere to go. And I wasn't built to live on the streets. So, I showed up at the hospital, Staten Island Hospital, at 5:30 in the morning. And it was, I remember it like it was yesterday. And it was raining. I was sitting out there and there was no like awning or anything. I was just sitting in the rain at the front door of this detox at the hospital. And I was waiting there because I knew that if I didn't get there early, there was going to be a line. I wouldn't be able to get into detox that day. And, I don't know if I walked into that detox thinking, I don't want to ever do drugs and alcohol again. At that point, I thought I was going to be doing drugs and alcohol my whole life. I was hopeless. I would go to sleep at night hoping that, I just didn't feel this way in the morning or I just didn't want to deal with it anymore. And, I walked into that hospital because I just didn't want to live the way I was living anymore. I didn't want to feel the way I felt anymore. And as soon as I walked in, they admitted me into detox. And I just told them, I told whoever would listen, I don't care what I need to do, just whatever I got to do, just tell me to do it. And I'll just send me there, send me wherever I got to go. And, I was sitting in the social worker's office the first night of detox and I'm talking to my sister and my sister's, hysterically crying. And she says to me, she says, I thought you were past the point of no return. And I just lost it, you know, and I just was, you know, I was just so beat up, and I was just so, like, mentally and, you know, emotionally drained, you know, and it's, I knew I could do better than what I was doing. I just, you know, I thought I was past the point of no return. I had given up, you know, I had no hope anymore. And, you know, I just, from that point on, I just did whatever people told me to do. And I just, you know, I looked at the people that were doing the right thing, and I just did what they did. And I went to detox for 7 days. I went up to the 28-day program in the hospital. I stayed there. And then they sent me to this place called St. Christopher's in Garrison, New York. And it's in the mountains of upstate New York. And, you know, they call it a homeless shelter for men. And, you know, at this point, I've got some, so, you know, a few days under my belt, you know, 30 days, and I'm still sick. I'm still dope sick. I still feel like I'm, you know, going through withdrawals. And I walk into this place, and, you know, everybody's shaking your hand. It's 160 guys. Everybody's got a collared shirt on. It's run by priests. You know, and it's, I didn't know what I was getting myself into. But as soon as I walked in, everybody started shaking my hand, introducing themselves. You know, they brought me up to my room. I was in a room with 20 other guys. When you walked in that room, you couldn't talk. You had to make your bed every single morning. When you lined up for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, you couldn't speak. You know, it wasn't the easiest place to live in. But it was the best experience I've ever had in my entire life. I, you know, met my best friend there. I met a lot of really good friends. And again, I looked around the room, and whoever was doing the right thing and whoever seemed happy, I just tried to do what they were doing. And, you know, I stayed there for 3 months, and, you know, within that 3 months, you know, they started setting up my discharge plans. And, you know, my sister had started to, me and her had started to talk again. She's really happy with what I was doing. And she offered that I come and stay with her. And I had lived with her before. You know, at this point she had 4 kids, and, you know, she had a lot on her, you know, she had her own family, and, you know, she had a lot on her plate. And, you know, I was going to go live with her, but, you know, I started making decisions that I wasn't able to make a year ago, a year before that. Things that were uncomfortable to me, you know, things that would have been hard, I started making harder, I started choosing the harder path instead of the easier path. And, you know, the discharge planner had mentioned to me, she said, listen, you know, some guys who used to come here, you know, they had started a halfway house in Florida. It's in West Palm Beach, you know, do you think, you know, that would be a good idea? And, you know, at first I didn't think anything of it, but, you know, my friends who I was close with, you know, they all were saying, you know, I think I'm going to do this. So, you know, I didn't have any money. You know, I couldn't ask my family. I didn't feel right asking my family for money. I'd asked them. So, you know, I'd done enough, you know, they had done enough for me. And, you know, I just, you know, I talked to my sister about it. She said, I'll buy you a plane ticket. You know, my mom said she'd give me like $100. And, you know, I said, you know what, I'm going to go to Florida. And I graduated from that facility. And I remember it. I left that treatment facility, and my mother and sister picked me up. They were going to bring me to Connecticut, you know, where my sister lived for like the night. And we stopped at a gas station. And I got out of the car, and, you know, I felt this overwhelming feeling of like anxiety and like, you know, like, what am I going to do? Because I learned so much, you know, that place educated me so much on my disease. They educated me on why I acted a certain way. And like, you know, what I needed to do to get better, you know, and I felt, you know, there was hope now, you know, I had this solution. I knew what I needed to do, but, you know, you take the drinks and the drugs away from somebody, you know, there's, you know, I'm still the same person. You know, I'm not going to be cured in 3 months, in 4 months. And I still felt like the same person. I was still, you know, I was anxious. And, you know, I got on that plane to Florida and I got to the sober house and, you know, they said, listen, you got to get a sponsor. You got to do the steps. You got to go to meetings. And I just, you know, I was so ready to do it. The guy who told me to get a sponsor, I was like, will you be my sponsor? And he laughed at me and he goes, no, I won't. You got to go find a sponsor that you know, that you want you're going to hear him share and, you know, what you want, what he has. And, you know, I went to a meeting, I got a sponsor, I did the steps. I started to make, you know, I started doing the right thing. You know, I developed such good relationships in that sober house. You know, I lived with, you know, my best friends there. And, you know, things got better quickly. And, you know, as time went on, within a few months, I was able to get my own apartment. I lived with, you know, three other guys from the sober house. We got a nice apartment. You know, I got my license back. It was suspended and I bought a new car. You know, I was going to meetings and just life was, you know, so much better. And, you know, it's in the beginning, you know, I didn't feel it. I didn't set any expectations. I just did it. You know, I just didn't ask questions and I just did what everybody told me to do. And, you know, I lived in Florida for 3 years. You know, and you know, now I live in Roanoke, Virginia. You know, I was living in Florida, my roommate, with a roommate, and you know, he got an opportunity to work for American Addiction Centers. And then 6 months later, you know, I got the opportunity and I moved to Roanoke, Virginia. And, you know, I still go to meetings. You know, I don't sponsor anybody right now, but I sponsor people. You know, I thought my whole life that, you know, I wanted, you know, baseball was it, you know, I thought that was like, you know, once I lost baseball, I thought that I was done. I was like, what am I going to do now? You know, and, you know, when I was a kid, if I'm sitting in I'm sitting in first grade and, you know, the teacher says, what do you want to be for the rest of your life? You know, I raise my hand. I say, I want to be a baseball player. You know, the kid next to me probably says doctor or, you know, nurse or lawyer. You know, nobody in that crowd, nobody in that class raises their hand and says, I want to be a drug addict or an alcoholic. You know, I didn't choose that. You know, and I was hopeless. You know, I didn't feel like I could, you know, take care of myself. And, you know, to this day, you know, now, you know, I wake up every single morning and I thank God that I overdosed. I thank God that, you know, I was homeless. I thank God for everything that I went through because, you know, if I didn't go through that stuff, I wouldn't have the opportunities that I have now. And I wouldn't be able to share my story with other people. I wouldn't be able to, you know, talk to people about their addiction or their alcoholism. And, you know, now I get the opportunity to help people. And, you know, that's what helps me stay sober. That's, you know, that's what keeps me sober is, you know, being able to help another alcoholic, addict or alcoholic, you know, with their issues. And, you know, I can't make anybody do anything, but, you know, if I could share my story and they could take something out of that, or, you know, if they listen to me and take something out of that and make the decision to go get help, or, you know, make the decision to pick up a big book and start doing the steps, you know, then, you know, I feel blessed, and I could, you know, go to sleep at night knowing that I'm doing the right thing. And, you know, that's, you know, it's a better feeling than, you know, anything that I've ever experienced before. I was just on the phone with somebody, and, you know, they said to me, you know, someone who's struggling, and they said to me, you know, in 6 months I could be in business school, and alcohol is the only thing holding me back. And, you know, when I asked that person if they're ready for treatment, they say, I don't know. But, you know, really think about what you can accomplish without drugs or alcohol. And, you know, for me, I was so hopeless. I never thought I could get better. But when I finally made that decision to just, you know, get out of my own way, things got better so much quicker, you know, so much quicker than it would. Yeah, it would have never got better. It only gets worse. And, yeah, I'm lucky that I never, you know, I haven't been in jail. I'm lucky that, you know, a lot of things haven't happened, you know, because, you know, that type of stuff could happen at any, you know, any moment.